Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Governor Phil Scott says he'll lift virtually all COVID-19 restrictions as soon as 80% of all eligible Vermonters have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine, and the state is very close to achieving this goal. In its most recent report, the Vermont Health Department says roughly 77% of people 12 and older fall into this category. And after being in place for 14 months, this means many restrictions could soon be eliminated. The governor is also making it very clear that after achieving the 80% goal, he's going to continue to encourage Vermonters to get vaccinated.
I want folks to know that when we do hit 80%, we're not going to be satisfied. While it will be safe to remove restrictions at that point, we're still going to push hard to get as many Vermonters vaccinated as possible. Because with all the infrastructure we have in place, and knowing the fall and winter may bring more transmission amongst the unvaccinated, we want to get that unvaccinated number as low as we possibly can right now.
There are a lot of questions about how life will return to normal once these restrictions have been lifted. And here to help us understand some of these changes is Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Tracy, great to have you back on the program.
Happy to be back, Bob. Thank you so much.
Tracy, some people might be wondering, this 80% goal is out there. What's the magic of 80%? Because it doesn't represent fully vaccinated people, only folks who have gotten at least one dose. So put that 80% number in some perspective for us.
Sure. This is all about really trying to reach our herd immunity or community immunity. We know that vaccines work best at a community level. While they're effective at an individual level, they really depend upon their effectiveness in some ways depends upon how much infection is in your community. So when we have fewer cases and we have more people vaccinated, the power of the vaccine is even more powerful. And so the goal of 80%, again, we don't have an exact number on it, exactly what percentage will protect us. We know the higher, the better. We know that between 70 and 80 is likely effective, but closer to 80 is better. The governor mentioned that, you know, with winter coming up later this year, we want to have as many people vaccinated as possible. And while Vermont, with its very low cases and high vaccination rate, feels quite secure, we do have plenty of states that have very much lower vaccination rates and higher case rates. And of course, we live in a world where only 22% of adults in the world who are eligible are vaccinated. And with our global lifestyle for a lot of people, it's so important to get that vaccine now to protect our communities and ourselves.
There might be some listeners who are wondering, why not wait until 80% of Vermonters are fully vaccinated? Would that make a difference?
It would. I mean, if we chose to wait until 80 were fully vaccinated, it would provide even more protection. However, we're also trying to balance the other important issues we're seeing here. If our case rates were higher, we might say, okay, let's wait till full vaccination. But with the declining case rates, that tells us that we have less virus circulating in our community. So we're feeling comfortable given what we know about what happens after a first dose. After a first dose, with these vaccines, there is a very high rate of protection, even higher, of course, once you get your second dose. But because of what we know about first doses and what we're seeing in other countries who have chosen to do the first dose method, we are feeling comfortable that that will provide us sufficient protection to move forward on opening up Vermont more. But of course, that second dose is really what brings it home and really gives you the maximum protection.
So, Tracy, what would you say to those folks who feel the state's taking a risk here, and it's too early to eliminate some of these restrictions? What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, I would say I understand where you're coming from. We have been living in a state of heightened concern and heightened caution for a long time, rightly so. But really, in Vermont, we have just been we have really been directed by the data over and over. And if we go back to the data now, we see low hospitalizations. We see no death in the last week, and we've seen much lower deaths. And most importantly, we see very low cases. And so all of that gives us more confidence in being able to lift some of these restrictions. And we are probably one of the most cautious states in the country. And so even with our vaccination rates, the governor has really been hesitant to move forward too quickly. And so it feels like for all of those reasons, we have been cautious, but we also want to catch up to other states in our region when it makes sense to do so. And we think this is about the time it makes sense to do so, particularly once we reach that 80% mark.
Today on the program, our guest is Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. You've got a question, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. It appears that the state of Vermont is probably in the next week or 10 days. It's hard to project exactly when we're going to hit the magic 80% rate. Last I looked, we needed about 15,000 more people to be vaccinated, and that could happen in a matter of days or a week or so. Your thoughts about that? 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Betsy, who is calling from Bristol. Hey, Betsy, welcome to the program.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay. Yeah, so my question was to talk about the young children. I feel like in all this rush to open and, you know, excitement over reaching 80% and vaccination rate and all this and that, people seem to have forgotten that there's a whole world there of families with children under 12, you know, toddlers, babies. What about them? And how can we, you know, address the needs to keep those kids protected and support those families?
That's a great question. I think I have four points to sort of address that. The first point being that the most protective thing that's happening in Vermont right now is vaccination. And so as vaccination occurs, we see a more protected population on the whole, which protects people on the whole, even the unvaccinated. It doesn't mean that it confers full protection, but the more people we get vaccinated, it increases the protection even for the unvaccinated because it's simply less virus moving around. So we have very low rates. Our positivity rate is around 1%, but the actual case rate is very low, much lower than the rest of the country. Another piece here is that among children, we simply don't see the number of cases. It appears that children, for whatever reason, their biological makeup appear to be less susceptible to COVID-19 compared to adults, and that may be related to receptors. The third piece is that they appear to be less likely to be passing it along compared to adults. But I would say the bigger overarching piece there is that with our higher vaccination rates and lower case rates, they're simply not at the same risk that they would have been several months ago. And then finally, of course, we've got the 12 to 15-year-olds getting vaccinated now. And likely in the fall, we will probably see Pfizer coming through with a vaccine approval for 2 to 11-year-olds. So it's coming. But balancing everything, including the need for people to be able to get together, to move about, to engage with each other and to socialize. And then looking, of course, at that bigger picture of the protection we've already got with vaccination and low case rates. We don't think there is a high risk to children. In fact, there's a very low risk to children moving forward in this way.
Betsy, thanks for that phone call. Tracy, let me follow up on some of Betsy's questions. Should children be wearing a mask if they're interacting with unvaccinated adults?
I would say that children should be following the same guidance as everyone else, other than in the school setting where we are still masking throughout the end of the year. So if you're outside, you don't need to wear a mask. Right now, if you're indoors and you're unvaccinated in a crowded area, and you're above the age, you know, I believe the age limit that we put on it. Now I don't have it in front of me. I believe it's a four years old and younger. We said no masks. So if you're of the age where you should be wearing a mask, then you should wear that. If you're in an indoor, more crowded setting and you are unvaccinated.
I also saw that some CDC research shows that schools are not a major source of community transmission, but that extracurricular activities are a different story. Tell us about that.
Yes. We know that schools, because of the great work they've done in actually ensuring physical distancing and ensuring mask wearing, and really the remarkable job the teachers have done in ensuring that they follow all the rules and don't bring the virus into the school, schools have been relatively low in terms of cases and transmission within schools. But outside of school, you have more connections. So when people are going to a sports event or another event, they may be in the car in an enclosed area, much closer for longer periods, or they may be gathering in ways that they might not gather at school, and with a lot more adults. School is pretty protected. You know, you've got primarily the teachers and the other staff at the school who have all been, as I say, very careful. But when you have a mix of more adults involved, you will see a different outcome. Now, of course, that's radically changing, particularly in Vermont, as you see many, many adults getting vaccinated. That risk goes down even in the extracurricular environment.
Tracy, as we've mentioned on a number of occasions, the state is really putting on sort of the full court press to bring the vaccine to people in order to get the rate up as high as possible. There are walk-in clinics, drive-in clinics, places that you don't need reservations. How is the state ensuring that the folks who get their first vaccine this way actually get the second one as well?
Well, for the most part, almost everywhere where we're giving a first dose, we are going back to give the second dose. And so that is the best way. It's easiest for people to remember to come back 3 weeks later, for example, if it's a Pfizer, preferably at the same time, at the same location. So up until now, that's what we've been doing. We do allow for walk-ins, obviously for first dose, but even for second dose. So some people may choose not to go back to the original location for their second dose, and they may walk in and get a second dose in another location. Now, as we move forward and as we have smaller and smaller numbers and we do more and more to get to people and help them access, we may be able to see even more and more ways to get a second dose at a different location. But we have found it really successful and simple for people to come back to the same location, same time for their second dose.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mark, who is calling from Putney. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
We're doing great.
Hello? Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, it's been interesting to me for almost a year now. You know, every time we get a good report that doing the things we're supposed to do to drive the numbers down and stuff, we decide, oh, great, it's worked, so let's quit doing it. It seems like a strange response. I recognize that now that numbers are down where they were, that's not as strange as it used to be. But it's been a kind of response ever since we started doing the right thing. And we've had what's happened is that we've stopped doing the right thing, and the numbers have gone back up, and we started doing the right thing again. And, 80% sounds pretty good, but 80%, that's 80% of half the vaccine. I think our governor's done a pretty good job compared to a lot of states, but I just find that response of gee, we're doing the right thing, let's stop doing it, is very strange.
So, Mark, is it your feeling that the state is when we do hit the 80% threshold, that the state is moving too quickly in eliminating some of these restrictions?
I think that's been the trend all along. Like I said, I think the numbers say that Governor Scott's done a pretty good job, and our state's done a pretty good job. I'm talking about the response more than our particular state's response. Just
the
idea that that seems strange to me. That hey, we're doing the right thing; it's working. Let's stop doing it.
Oh, Tracy, how do you respond to Mark?
Oh, well, I absolutely hear where Mark is coming from. And this conversation has happened over and over, to be honest, in the health department and, with the governor and his staff. We do weigh this all the time, this sense of, okay, the numbers are going in the right direction. Do we continue this? What are the behavioral effects of lifting or not lifting? How will the public respond? Will we be able to keep them on board if we continue in this direction? How do you motivate people? I mean, we weigh so many different pieces. We're you know, public health, obviously, number one, but then trying to understand human behavior, trying to understand economic impacts, and then looking at a brand new pandemic and looking at data from other countries. What happened in Israel when they did it? What happened over in Europe when they did it? And it's been, you know, obviously there have been some sad and tragic times, but it's also been fascinating for a lot of the reasons that Mark talked about. You know, when do you pull back? When don't you pull back? The numbers have gone up at times, probably less in Vermont because we've pulled back, but certainly nationally, you've seen people drop mask mandates too soon. I think in Vermont, we have been cautious, but he's right. We've certainly seen that probably more nationally. Now, of course, we are in a different place with a long trend of very low numbers. But of course, we're going to keep watching it, which is why the governor wanted to hold until 80% here. You know, a very high goal, probably higher than any other state's goal right now. But it's really because of that caution, you know, hey, we don't want to move too quickly and see a slide. So all really good points and really part of all the thinking and learning that we do all the time around this.
Tracy, I wanted to give you an opportunity to clarify something that came up yesterday at the governor's press briefing. One of the reporters asked a question about the number of people who have died in Vermont due to the vaccine. And they seem to mistakenly look at a CDC site where there's self-reporting going on and saying that that was actually a report from the CDC. I don't know if I've made that clear, but maybe you could straighten this out.
Sure, yeah. There have been no deaths as a result of COVID-19 vaccines in Vermont. I actually spoke with our medical examiner this morning because I did hear that question yesterday. What the reporter was referring to is a registration, a database called VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Events Registry. And that registry allows and encourages people to submit reports on anything that happens to them after a vaccine. And it also requires medical providers to report on any kind of adverse event after a vaccine. Even if the adverse event doesn't appear to have anything to do with the vaccine, medical providers are required to report some events. So if a physician gives a vaccine and then a couple of weeks later, somebody passes away due to a medical event, that provider is required to actually report that into VAERS. And so you will see at any time in any state reports of deaths, and then there will be a vaccine associated with it. And all that means is that this event occurred after the administration of a vaccine within a certain time period. So you can imagine we have a very high number of elderly people who have been vaccinated in a short period. Some of those people also have other health conditions and may have passed away within days or weeks of receiving that vaccine, and it may not have any association. The benefit of this data and this registry is that the CDC takes a look at any death report or serious report, and then they look for trends to see if something's happening that might suggest an actual causal link. If they see something that concerns them, they let the state know. So they would let us know and say, hey, we're going to open up an investigation into this case. Were they to find something that indicated that the vaccine did cause a death, we would then go back and change our records. But at this time, and I did speak to our chief medical examiner this morning to confirm, there are no death certificates in Vermont that indicate that the vaccine is a cause or a contributing cause of death in Vermont. However, on the VAERS database, there are 8 deaths listed as having occurred after someone received a vaccine.
So it sounds like the VAERS database is being used to alert the CDC and public health officials to possible trends, but are not necessarily documented cases?
Yeah, they are not documented cases of cause. They could be documented cases. For example, if a medical provider reports it in, that's likely a documented case. However, anyone can report in. So if I think that I see my neighbor having an adverse event, I can report in. Or if my sister had a vaccine and got a fever as a result, you know, I may report that in, or she may, or the provider may. So anyone can report in. And again, a very useful database because it can start to show trends that would be important, especially for a vaccine that's relatively new and that's being used on such a wide scale. But again, not new. You will always find adverse events after a vaccine, including sometimes deaths. And in most cases, it does not indicate causation. And they would alert us if they felt that it did or if they were to open up a case investigation.
Tracy, I really appreciate you clarifying that for us because there was some confusion after the press briefing. I think a lot of people would be relieved to hear your answer to that question. Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Doug, who's calling from Springfield. Hi, Doug. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. What's your question today?
So, first I'd like to congratulate the doctor and her colleagues on the great progress we've made so far. It's really good, and it shows what a team can do when they really put their minds to it, not only the medical community, but the administration and enforcement as well. But my comment is regarding the other epidemic we have in Vermont, the opioid epidemic. We lost over 130 people last year, Vermonters, to that epidemic, which is over half of what we lost to COVID this year. So I suggest, and you're probably already thinking of this, that the administration and medical community think about how to take the lessons they've learned from COVID and strongly apply those to the opioid epidemic.
And Doug, are there some things that jump out at you that you've seen the state do with COVID that you think would be applicable to the opioid epidemic?
Well, I think in this medical situation, we've seen our governor step in with really almost draconian executive actions. Think about what the governor could do to combat the opioid epidemic if he had the authority to take more strong action against drug dealers and the infusion of fentanyl and heroin into Vermont at the borders.
Tracy, are there some things, as Doug mentioned, that perhaps the state has learned during the COVID pandemic that could be applied to the opioid epidemic?
Yes, Doug's question is really timely because as we begin to transition, we're not out of this yet, as you know, but as we begin to transition and think of our longer term COVID response, we are thinking about what are the lessons that we're learning that we can apply to other public health issues. Now, the opioid situation has been critical in Vermont for a long time, and I think we have treated it very seriously. We've put a lot of resources into it. We've engaged all parts of the medical healthcare system, and certainly the governor has assigned task forces and made really great strides. But I like the idea of, you know, we really saw with this pandemic what it means when you apply an incredible sense of urgency, which was necessary. How do we build that immediacy and that urgency around something that often takes place over a longer period of time? And that is one of the challenges. There are things that our society accepts and things that our society doesn't accept. And sadly, it appears that drug use and deaths from drug use tend to be something that we have somehow gotten used to. And that sense of urgency is important. And so whether it's the governor taking stronger measures, I'm not sure about that. However, reapplying and re-upping our urgency around this. The Department of Health has a division that's focused on this issue and has certainly received more federal funds. You may not hear about that as much, but with COVID, federal funds for a lot of other public health programs have increased because in almost all areas, those areas that have either been neglected or have simply gotten worse over a period of time where people weren't able to get the care that they would normally have needed because of what we had to do for the pandemic. And so we do have more funding. So we're increasing all of our evidence-based practices. But it is a very difficult time. This situation with our opioid overdoses has not gone away. And actually, in speaking again with the chief medical examiner, I'm referring to him a lot today, he talked about, you know, as he looks at the deaths coming in during the pandemic, stress has caused people to do a lot more of the behaviors, their unhealthy behaviors, and to do those more, you know, in the same way that we all might fall back on unhealthy behaviors. If you had a substance use disorder, you may be engaging in that more during this period. And so there are a lot of ways to get help. I should mention that if you go to the Department of Health website, there are all kinds of resources there if you need help. But in the meantime, yes, I think the bigger cry, which is let's attach more urgency to this, let's refresh, is something we're very seriously looking at and trying to do.
Let me expand on Doug's comment a little bit and ask you, what have we learned in the last 14 months that we can apply for the next pandemic? I mean, it seems that when I hear Commissioner Levine talking about it, that the pandemic is, to some degree, COVID is going to be with us for the foreseeable future, but we may be dealing with another pandemic 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. Have we learned something in terms of how we respond to it that we'll be ready for it next time?
Normally after an emergency, we do a pretty big procedure called a hot wash, where we review everything that's happened and everything we've learned and then how to apply those lessons. We haven't had that formal process yet, but I can say informally, I think some of the things we've learned, and again, we did aspects of all of this, but we could probably strengthen, coming in as early as we can. We, of course, did set up a health operations center and our state operations center early, but nobody anticipated how big this could get. We had been hearing for decades that a big pandemic would come. It almost felt unreal at times, even though we know it could come. I think one thing we've learned is there's really nothing too big that we could prepare for in the future. So being prepared early on with every aspect, going bigger than public health early on, being ready for the mitigation measures early on. We certainly did a lot of communication with the public, and we've learned that the public highly values that. So starting that as early as possible as well. So some of the things I would say that we've learned are things that we did well, but maybe we would do them bigger and earlier and maybe anticipate a little bit more. We normally a vaccine takes quite a while. And so most states were caught a little flat-footed with how quickly the vaccine arrived. Now that we know that a vaccine with all of these resources can move this quickly and technology changing, can we be even more ready with our healthcare partners, primary care partners, and other partners and pharmacies to be ready to put it out? We were pretty ready. Could we be even more ready? Probably yes in the future.
Today in the program, our guest is Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. Perhaps you have some thoughts or some questions about, as the state approaches this 80% threshold of having eligible Vermonters with at least one dose of the vaccine, a lot of restrictions are going to be lifted. Seems like that's going to be happening in the very near future. 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to David in Wilmington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing great.
Okay, so my question is, can a person contract the COVID virus if they are exposed to a mist coming off an impounded river? And, you know, as the water spills over the dam, it creates a mist. If this river has treated sewage effluent released into it.
Tracy, what do
sure,
you think?
I can take that. The main route for transmitting COVID has been person to person through airborne droplets and through that type of activity. So I can't speak to the theoretical nature of this, but there are no cases that I'm aware of where anyone has contracted COVID from being near a river and any sort of mist coming off of it related to sewage. So the chances would be negligible to none in that case.
That's good to know. You know, we were talking earlier about what's going to be happening in the next 6 months, in the next year. Do you think it's likely that, sort of like getting a flu shot every year, we should be probably ready for getting a COVID vaccine or a booster every year or so?
We are hearing about a booster. Our best estimate is that the booster might be something that's required a year from your first shot. Again, that's a guess, but not necessarily hearing about an annual booster. Annual shots happen, for example, the flu shot, when we see a lot of mutation and so that the virus changes significantly. There have been some variants in this virus, but early on we saw that the virus, this particular SARS-CoV-2 does mutate rather slowly. So it's hard to say right now, but we anticipate, based on what we're hearing from the pharmaceutical industry and what we're hearing from CDC, that a booster may be likely. Less sure that that would necessarily be annual. That would depend in part about on how this virus behaves and whether or not that would be needed.
Tracy, we got an email from a listener who wants to know how different hospitals put their policies together in terms of having people visiting and how many people can be in a patient's room. And they're wondering, is this a policy that is being set by the state of Vermont, the state telling various hospitals, this is what you can do and this is what you can't do, or is it being done more on an individual basis?
The state does set some minimum guidelines and did early on in this response, particularly as hospitals were opening back up. And we talked about what could be open. We talked about particularly testing requirements for staff, et cetera. And I believe we also addressed masking. However, hospitals do have a lot of discretion, and some of them have gone beyond, you know, what the state required as a minimum. And moving forward, even as we move into eventually when we hit 80%, the mask-free environment, hospitals will still have some of their own requirements. The CDC calls out the healthcare sector as one sector that should still have different considerations moving forward. Some of that depends on whether or not they are treating COVID in their hospitals or the case rates in their communities. So it is hospital by hospital. But we have seen throughout the year that, for example, some hospitals required either double masking or an N95 mask in some areas where others hospitals require just a surgical mask. Some hospitals continuing to take temperatures, some hospitals not. So there has been some variation. And I would say moving forward, for the most part, you will see hospitals taking that on and really determining their own policies. You know, again, that is a more fragile environment. And so you can understand why things would be different. But our hope is, and I know the hospitals certainly are moving toward certainly allowing as much visitation as needed, but possibly with still some mitigating measures.
So let's say for a moment that we hit this 80% threshold sometime in the next week or so, so that we've already reached it just for the sake of discussion. When people go shopping, will they still be wearing masks when they go into stores?
They won't be required to wear masks as per the state mandate when they go into stores once we each reach 80%. I believe businesses could still require what they choose to require in a store. We anticipate that, but most businesses wouldn't require that. And of course, there are going to be some people who just may feel more comfortable still, who may be concerned about things like, you know, 20% of people are still unvaccinated. I'm concerned about that. Or who may have medical conditions that put them more at risk. And so they may choose to do so. But for the most part, once we reach 80%, we don't anticipate that stores will require it. Certainly the state won't require it. And we anticipate that most people will not need to wear masks and therefore that businesses will be unlikely to ask them to.
Just to be clear, though, if an individual business, retail business in particular, wants to keep the mask mandate in place for the next couple of weeks, are they allowed to do that?
To the best of my knowledge, businesses can determine rules for what happens inside their store. But I don't want to overstate there. I think that that may be a legal question as well. But to the best of my knowledge, a store can have requirements that go above and beyond what a government requires for their own business.
And that same principle would be true for individual towns, wouldn't it?
I believe towns also have the flexibility, as we've seen with Burlington, for example, who continued some policies. I believe also towns do have the ability if they choose to do so. For the most part, towns have been mostly in lockstep with where we've been going as a state. But yes, to the best of my understanding, towns do have some flexibility to go above and beyond.
So what do you think the biggest change will be for folks as we hit that 80% threshold? Will it be that the state mandate for a mask will be dropped, social distancing? How do you think it'll affect people the most?
I think it'll affect people the most by reducing anxiety. People have been just heightened for a long time, and understandably so. And although 80%, of course, isn't an actual magic number, it feels like that because we really are talking about that as being a more protective place. And so I think that will be the primary feeling that occurs is a reduction in anxiety. I'm already seeing it. I'm seeing people's faces look more relaxed as we're getting to a better place. And then behaviorally, I think people getting together with other people more. You're already starting to see that among vaccinated people, getting together, having dinner, no mask, and just enjoying each other's company. I don't know that we'll see a lot of people rush to large indoor venues. We'll see some people comfortable with that. Others, I anticipate they may want to hold off a little bit longer, or some people may choose to wear a mask. I mean, right now, I'm going into some places where it states if you're vaccinated, you don't need to wear a mask. But if I see people in there with a mask on, I'm putting a mask on because I don't want them to feel uncomfortable. I may continue that. If I go into a place and I see a few people with masks, I may put a mask on, recognizing that there might be people in there who are immune compromised and still nervous. And so I think we're in this transition, and once we get to 80%, we still may see some a variety of behaviors.
We've got Memorial Day weekend coming up, a time traditionally of picnics, families, friends getting together. What kind of general advice do you have for folks this year?
I encourage people to get together. If you're vaccinated, in particular, get together. But if it's an outside event, really anyone can come together without a mask and gather with your family, with your friends. Again, if it's an indoor gathering and it's more crowded, if you're unvaccinated, you are still required to wear a mask. But really, get outside, get active. I mean, the weather is getting better. And almost anything that you would want to do, you should be able to do this weekend for the most part. And particularly if you're vaccinated, there are really no real limits on that. And so I hope people do get outside. I hope they take advantage of all the great businesses that we have in Vermont and the opportunities to eat and to come together that way and to go to all of our great recreational places. Again, this is an important part of your health, is getting together with other people socially and being physically active. I think some people actually got more physically active over this pandemic and got outside more. So I hope that trend stays. I hope we've still got sold out signs on the bike stores because everybody wants to get outside. I think that's been a wonderful trend, and I hope it continues.
What do you think, something that you've missed in the last 14 months, that when we hit 80%, you're going to go, all right, I can get to do this again?
Oh, I can tell you exactly what that is. For me, that's comedy for me. I love live entertainment. I love comedy. And I can't wait to be with other people and to laugh and to see live performances around Vermont. That's the thing I'm most excited about. I think everyone's got their thing. I've got friends who do different kinds of sports, and they can't wait to get back on their sports team. I can't wait to go to my kids. I play ultimate frisbee, and my daughter does too. I can't wait to go to her games and relax with everyone else with no mask and enjoy them, watching them run around and play. So all those kind of group things that are fun, where we can laugh and enjoy each other, that's what I look forward to the most.
Did I read somewhere that you enjoy doing stand-up?
I do. I sure do. I like that. That's my other passion besides public health. And I love to do it. And, you know, that's why I said that's one of the things I can't wait to do. But really, that's a high-risk activity that we could not do during the pandemic. Not only is it people getting together inside, but laughter, you know, sadly, during the pandemic was not something that you could safely do among groups. It's similar to singing in that way. And so that's a nice change that I'm looking forward to for the Vermont Comedy Club to open up, but also all the different venues, the Flynn, all of the local venues where there's music, all of the important things that make Vermont and who it is.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Caitlin, who's calling from Rutland. Hi, Caitlin. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I was just in response to a question you asked a little earlier, I'm thinking I will keep the mask in my arsenal of cold weather wear because I work in food service, and usually two or three times a season we'll have a case of the sniffles or a cold hits the restaurant and various people are down. That hasn't happened in 18 months, and I it's got to be the mask, so I'm going to keep that in my pocket for the next cold flu season and hopefully keep up with that trend of not having the sniffles.
Tracy, I think I've read, following up on what Caitlin said, that the number of cases of flu were actually down this year because people were wearing a mask so often. Is that true?
Yes, the cases of flu were significantly down. And the same thing that was protecting us from transmission of COVID-19, which was really that distancing and the masking, is also, of course, effective for anything else that transmits through respiratory droplets or airborne transmission. And so I think it's a great idea. I mean, there are plenty of countries where mask wearing during flu and cold seasons is very common. It might not be for everyone, but like your caller, I also plan to keep some masks on hand. And either if I don't feel well or if I'm in an environment where it looks like it's cold or flu season, I may use that mask sometimes as well.
Let's talk to Fran, who's calling from Weathersfield. Hi, Fran. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I have an unusual perspective in that until February 14th, I was living in Yerevan, Armenia. I'm a native Vermonter, but I've been a teaching principal in six different countries over the last 10 years. So I had to come home at that point. And I'm calling to give a little bit of perspective because my local friends here, they worry, are we doing the right thing? Is it really okay? And I have the opposite perspective where people were doing nothing. And in fact, in some of the countries in which I lived, I had to come home in February because it was too dangerous to be there. The hospitals were full of wounded soldiers as Armenia was involved in a war. There were no hospital beds. There was no mask wearing. At one point, half my local staff was out with COVID. We almost had to close the school. So the Scott administration, the state of Vermont, your guests today have done an amazing job. And I know that because I've lived in places where they weren't doing such a good job. So thank you for that.
Fran, thank you for your phone call. Tracy, a very interesting perspective for us to get.
It is. And, I'm going to pass that thanks along to Dr. Levine and to all of our staff at the Department of Health and all of the other staff across state government healthcare. So many people have made this work. And number one, the people who have made this work are simply the people of Vermont who have sacrificed so much and our elderly. My God, every day we cannot forget the sacrifices that our elderly people in nursing homes have made, the loneliness, the illness that they have borne, but also they've really stuck to tough requirements to protect themselves and to protect us. Yeah, I think she brings a great perspective. You know, what is sad is that I'm so proud that we are in a state where we're able to do this, but it is privilege, and we've got to acknowledge that there are countries across the world that do not have the resources that we have. There was a commission set up specifically to ensure that vaccine would be allocated equitably across the world, and it didn't work. And we have India going through just a nightmare. We've seen other countries also with low resources and therefore poor health infrastructure and poor vaccination because they don't have the resources. And so we are lucky, and some of it is hard work, and some of it is, of course, the cooperation. But we all have to remember that some of this is privilege, and we are lucky to have been born where we're born. And please keep the rest of the world in mind as they continue to suffer, in some cases, very seriously due to this pandemic.
Very good point. Let's see if we can get a very quick call in from Rob in Rutland. Hey, Rob, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you? Thank you. Calling from Rutland, representing Land Growth. And just my question is, my daughter, 17-year-old daughter, has been out of state this year and got vaccinated and is back home, and she's a Vermont resident. How does she and people like her get counted?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we actually work with other states. So if other states vaccinate a resident, states share information, so we're able to count her through that. She doesn't need to do anything. We receive information about our residents from other states, and those numbers come into our system and into our immunization registry. Probably if she has a healthcare provider here, that healthcare provider will eventually meet with her, see that she's been vaccinated, and likely enter that. But if she has questions, she can actually call our vaccine call center, and they will be able to guide her correctly if she wanted to double check that in any way.
Tracy, just before we end, any sense of when we're going to hit this 80% threshold?
You know, I certainly don't want to go out ahead of the governor on that. We were vaccinating around 2,000 people a day. I think yesterday it was 1,900. We've got tons of clinics coming up in schools. Our 12 to 15-year-olds are doing a great job. Our young adults, you know, still continuing to really push with them as well. But, you know, could be sometime next week. We really need to get to that 15,000 number. That's how many we have left to get to 80%. And then, of course, the work isn't done, right? Then we keep working on it. But that number and the lifting and the changing of some of the requirements for bars, restaurants, et cetera, hopefully later next week, could be earlier, but I wouldn't want to overstate that.
Well, after 14 months of living in a world upside down because of this pandemic, it appears the state of Vermont is pretty darn close to returning to some form of normalcy. Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan, many thanks, as always, for taking the time to discuss these important issues with us.
Thank you.